Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. I'm happy to announce that this episode is a COVID-19 free zone. When the Prime Minister gave his annual Closing the Gap speech to Parliament on 12th of February this year, he declared that, quote, the results are not good enough, unquote. He went on to say that it was time to redesign and refresh the Closing the Gap policy. He said, quote, we support the process of co-design of The Voice because if we are going to change the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples on the ground, we need their buy-in to the matters and policies that affect them, unquote. Not everyone in the Indigenous health space agreed with Mr. Morrison's language or his goals. My special guest today is Associate Professor Chelsea Bond, who is Principal Research Fellow within the School of Social Science at the University of Queensland. Chelsea is a proud Mununjali and South Sea Islander woman. She and her colleague Dr. David Singh have written a perspective for the MJA, which suggests it's time to call time on closing the gap. Welcome, Chelsea. This is a cracking perspective you've written here. Every year at this time, we start reviewing research, we start publishing stuff, and it's all this Indigenous versus non-Indigenous. You know, Indigenous are three times more likely to be whatever.
Yeah.
That's entirely the wrong approach, isn't it?
Well, I think, you know, the story of ill health is one that we now are pretty familiar with for those of us working in health in terms of the crisis that is Indigenous health. And that awareness raising was necessary. We saw it sort of emerge in the 90s and the start of the century because for a long time, Australian public health ignored Indigenous health. It's part of the reason why we're at. For those who looked at the history of public health in this country, it hasn't got a good one when it comes to Indigenous people. But now that we know about health inequality, the question is, what do we do about it? And how can we have better informed strategies to remedy the gap of health inequality? And I think that's the challenge facing us now is this is not a matter of an evidence base of a problem. This is a matter of an evidence-based strategy.
So when Scott Morrison, in his Closing the Gap speech, decides to refresh the targets, that doesn't solve much, does it?
Well, I'm not confident in that. And I think that the point that Dr. David Singh and I try and make in the article is we actually need to look at the power relationships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia. And until we look at that, well, we're never going to close this gap that we're talking about. And so just changing the targets because we haven't met the other targets, it's kind of like window dressing, you know? And I think it's, well, let's actually look at this whole arrangement, who is it working for? Because there are beneficiaries of closing the gap investment. There's been a big investment of funding and research. The question that we have is it getting to Indigenous peoples, the Indigenous community-controlled health sector, Indigenous health researchers? And that still remains, I think, a challenge of when do Indigenous people get to lead in the strategising around improving Indigenous health?
Clearly that's not happening enough. What's happening instead?
No. So there is certainly the coalition of the peaks, of the peak Indigenous health bodies, which is, I don't want to dismiss the significance of that arrangement. And it's certainly a new thing that, our mob have fought very hard to get a seat at the table. But in terms of the power dynamic here, there is still an imbalance. The fact that we get to advise on a refresh of the targets, not completely reframe the strategy, is a limitation.
You make the point in your article that it's kind of setting up the peaks for being the fall guy when it doesn't work.
That would be my concern. And I, you know, I'm old enough to remember the ATSIC days.
Yes.
And remember reading the news reports where ill health was talked about in the context of ATSIC's failure.
Yeah.
Yet health was never part of its portfolio during this reporting period. And so those of us who worked in Indigenous affairs know full well that typically we don't get resourced to lead the interventions in Indigenous in health, yet we bear the brunt of the blame, whether it's the failure of our services or even the victim blaming of Indigenous peoples for not caring enough about our health.
And that victim blaming is also a point you raise in terms of Aboriginal ill health becoming about the behaviour of a group of people rather than about conditions that may have been forced on them by socioeconomic conditions. How did that happen? How did that dynamic become set up and not only set up but persisted for decades?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a problem of health more broadly. You know, the individual health behaviourist approach for addressing improving health, we know, has its limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And you look to the Whitehall studies, and we know about social determinants of health. We know about the importance of the social gradient in producing disparities in populations.
Yep.
We know that it's more than just diet, exercise, and smoking, you know, the holy trinity. Yet it is far easier to focus on those and focus on surveilling and controlling the individual than changing the way in which society works. And so we tend to invest in things that are measurable, that the state can exercise control over people. And look, of course we should be encouraging people to eat better foods and make sure that people have access to good food.
Yep.
That we should have a society that promotes an active lifestyle. And we know that, you know, Australia has been a world leader in tobacco control, and an important one. But what's interesting with smoking cessation is that Indigenous peoples have not benefited in the same way that the general population has when it comes to those investments. Now, an easy answer would, an easy explanation for that, and a common explanation we get for high rates of Indigenous smoking, is that Indigenous people, we don't care about our health, or we don't know, haven't realised yet that smoking is bad for our health. And so we see all these controls on Indigenous peoples around smoking cessation that don't actually deal with why have Indigenous people been resistant to mainstream smoking cessation campaigns. Now, I'm an ex-smoker, and I live in a community where there's a really high proportion of smokers.
Yes.
It's a poor neighbourhood, high Indigenous population. What I did some years ago is I did a small qualitative study with blackfellas in the community that I lived in who had given up, and I asked them, how did they give up? What were the enablers? Because every week at that service that I worked in, we would get the numbers of how bad smoking rates were, and particularly amongst pregnant mothers. And so everyone would be horrified at these numbers, but we weren't doing anything different. And what we found when I spoke to blackfellas who had quit was that much of the mainstream kind of strategies just didn't work in the same way. And so things like, you know, the state lecturing people about quitting, Indigenous people were resistant to that because the relationship with the state hasn't been a particularly healthy one for blackfellas.
Exactly right, yeah.
So there wasn't the kind of same level of trust that perhaps middle-class white Australians may have in the state. The other thing that was really interesting, so things like social stigma, which have been really powerful in discouraging smoking. It does. If you're black and you're poor, you kind of know what social stigma is. You experience it all the time.
Yes. If you can hack that, you can hack a bit of smoking stigma.
Well, and smoking was often medicating around that social stigma.
Yeah.
And so in looking at these stories, it was interesting. And what we know about smoking is that it's not, people don't smoke because they necessarily love it. But smoking does all these other things for people. And there are particular groups that are resistant to smoking cessation campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And they are blackfellas, poor people, people with mental illness, and people who have been incarcerated. What this tells us is not about how bad these groups are. It tells us about how power operates and what nicotine does when people feel powerless in terms of feeding that addiction.
Mm.
So we found health risk was not a motivator for any of the people who had quit. It didn't factor into the decision-making. What we found when we spoke to people who quit, it was about a significant life event change, stepping out of an unhealthy relationship, change in employment where their new identity was no longer congruent with being a smoker.
Mm.
What struck me, though, when we spoke to people, what struck me about one of the enablers were that there was a certain percentage of them that had a positive relationship with a health provider. It was for a quit line.
Right.
And I was shocked that Quitline was, you know, this anonymous person on the phone would be useful for blackfellas in Inala. I didn't think it would work. But what was interesting is that was the one relationship with a health provider that didn't chastise them for relapsing.
There you go.
So they were, what they said is, look, they offered support to me, and when I relapsed, they didn't rouse me. They actually said, it's okay, you can do this. And so we found that positive, supportive relationship was an enabler to smoking cessation. But typically in health, we don't do that. We do lecture. It's paternalistic. It's condescending.
Yep.
And so I knew myself, when people would lecture me about smoking, I'd go outside and have a cigarette. so there are some things that we do in health that just are counterproductive.
Yeah.
Of course, blackfellas, we care about our health. We want to see our elders reach the status of elder. But the strategies have not actually engaged with our life worlds. and have therefore been ineffective. But if we get blackfellas in charge of things, we do ask different questions. I, as an Indigenous person living in Inala, had a different question to ask as a health researcher, and through that found a new way of addressing smoking cessation. And so we implemented some changes in that health service. We did see a reduction in adult smoking rates in the clinic population, but most significantly, we changed how we spoke to smokers. And the GPs even said afterwards, going, the response we get from people when we say you could give up smoking rather than you should give up smoking, it just changed that relationship. That's the exciting part about what we can do in research, is actually change how we do things to achieve better results, rather than get caught up in this victim-blaming arrangement that I think we've been trapped in for too long.
I'm chatting today with Chelsea Bond from UQ. Her co-authored perspective is available at mja.com.au, where, like all our Indigenous content, it is open access. The current issue of the MJA is packed with articles on Indigenous health, including research, narrative reviews, and editorials. Don't forget to check out the rest of our podcasts at mja.com.au/podcasts. Back to our chat. So what are the barriers to having your mob run your own game here?
Can I say white people?
Yeah, of course you can.
I think, look, I'm going to joke, but yes. Look, if we look at, you know, who's getting the large bulk of research funding, it's certainly not Indigenous people. Certainly if you look to, like, the NHMRC, we have, of course, the Lower Institute that has really made a commitment to supporting Indigenous-led research, and I'm a beneficiary of those investments. It's relinquishing the attachment people have to ideas around race that insist that Indigenous people are incapable. Once we let go of that, we may not think of it as radical that Indigenous peoples might lead Indigenous strategies in health advancement. You know, because if we replace this with gender and talk about women's health and had to make a case for why women should be in charge of strategies around improving women's health, we wouldn't even have to make the case.
Hopefully.
But for some reason, in Indigenous health, in the colony, there's still this refusal to relinquish that kind of relationship of power over Indigenous peoples, even in the space of health, which is supposed to be this kind of benevolent, caring kind of space that is supposed to be committed to our survival. That's a real challenge still.
How do you change that? How do you get that to happen?
Well, look, I think there's lots of different strategies, and, you know, because what we know about power is it's never ceded. And so, you know, Indigenous intellectual warriorship is part of the strategy. It's part of why I do the work that I do as a researcher, but also as a public intellectual, because I came to health because I was committed to the survival of my people. And it was health was the vehicle at the time that I could do that, because there happened to be this university degree that I was able to undertake. I didn't think that health itself was the be-all, end-all, but it was certainly a way in which I could look at how to how do we survive in this place. But I became a researcher because I thought, if I get the evidence base, then maybe things could change, because we're told that everything is evidence-based.
That's it.
Turns out it's not so true. Go to any Aboriginal community that has a pilot program that had the findings that it worked, but yet has been unable to secure investment. I soon discovered, after years of working as a health researcher, that it actually didn't. The evidence base mattered, but it could only go so far.
Yeah.
And it made me sort of really appreciate that a medical solution to Indigenous health was not the only solution. This is a political problem.
Yep.
We need to be thinking about power relationships as part of this and reconfiguring those relationships. So for me as a scholar, I'm interested in, yes, producing the evidence base, but also looking at the strategizing around the political environment that we're forced to exist within. And so some of my work does sit more at the boundaries of the discipline I was trained within, but it has to, in order to shift things a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think there's the intellectual work that we still need to do around affecting change, but there's the political strategizing, and certainly the peaks are doing their work in trying to get a seat at the table. But it requires a sustained commitment for some time to reconfigure these power relationships.
Sure. Does party politics enter into this? Does it matter which brand of politician we're talking about?
Look, not for me, not really. I think that in a settler colonial state, whether a political party sits to the left or the right, it doesn't really change our relationship with the state.
Yeah, right.
Yep. One is just less obvious
yes.
We had the Labor Party come in after the NT, federally come in after the Northern Territory intervention and didn't effectively change it. It became, the Stronger Futures became the policy for the future, not just this crisis period. History tells us that it doesn't matter necessarily. And Indigenous issues in the colony don't sit neatly on the left or the right. I think we've been led to believe that. It doesn't work in the same way because race is a thing regardless of whether you're Labor or Liberal.
Closing the Gap's been around for what, 15 years?
Yep.
Has it done anything of any use?
I mean, I can't speak for Closing the Gap in its broader sense, in terms of all the different areas.
Sure.
Certainly there have been, we've seen a better resourcing of the community-controlled sector, only through their innovation, though, in terms of how to generate income through some of these measures that can then reinvest in expanding health services. And so we see it with the Urban Institute for Indigenous Health, as an example, and some of the Aboriginal community-controlled services here in southeast Queensland. We still haven't seen the redistribution of power, and I think that's the thing that concerns me. And I'm just curious, that Closing the Gap came in the aftermath of the claim that self-determination had failed. And I'm just waiting for the day that we say Closing the Gap has failed as a strategy. I mean, we've had now 12, I believe, annual reports in the floors of Parliament, 12 years of failure. Mm-hmm. And so when do we say, okay, this isn't working, perhaps we might look at Indigenous governance strategies more substantially across these areas. The other issue is that Closing the Gap is not something that Blackfellas asked for. Those priority areas, those indicators, they're not necessarily what we are calling for. And Closing the Gap strategy that fails to make mention of land, that didn't really attend to justice, mental health and well-being, there are so many silences in this space that, it's time to say, look, it's had its time and it's time for something different and it's time for Indigenous peoples to lead because we're kind of capable. It's a radical idea.
But I loved the conclusion of your perspective, which was if these ideas seem radical to you, that says more about the tragic state of affairs than it does anything else.
Often go to international forums where there are Indigenous people from across the world and they all feel sorry for us. Because here in Australia, it's pretty bad. We are 3% and we don't really have control over much of the things that are supposed to be for our benefit. And so I know that I grew up in a different time that my father grew up in, but there are too many things that are too similar to what he experienced in his lifetime.
How do we help enable this change to happen?
I think it's about, being engaged in the same kind of intellectual warriorship that Indigenous health scholars are doing, amplifying Indigenous voices, listening to them first and amplifying them as much as possible and applying the same scrutiny and gaze over Indigenous health and Indigenous affairs in other areas. I mean, the sports rort affair is one example there's sustained scrutiny over that funding, and rightly so, but yet we know about what Nigel Scott did as Indigenous Affairs Minister, and it's very similar, if not worse, in terms of what was resourced under his direction.
Yep.
Yet it didn't meet with the same scrutiny. So we actually need Whitefellas to care enough about Indigenous peoples as much as they say they do when they write those research grants for us.
Yeah.
And care and pay attention to what's happening to Indigenous peoples. We still have this kind of Henry Reynolds, why weren't we told business going on? And the question is, why aren't we paying attention?
Yeah, it's not why weren't we told, it's why weren't we looking.
Yeah. So I think if you're working in Indigenous health or doing any research as health researchers in this space, you cannot claim to take an objective neutral stance in this space. It is deeply political, and we all have our own vantage points that we're coming to in this space. And so we have to recognise that we have to be more conscious of the broader social, political, economic, historical context in which Indigenous health sits. So it means doing a bit more work than what our disciplines have trained us to do, because I did a health degree and I can't remember having any real engagement with critical race studies. We learnt how to take blood pressures and blood sugar levels. We didn't understand how to tackle systemic racism. We weren't given those tools. So part of my work in terms of my research is actually how do we then better train health researchers to understand the broader context with Indigenous health sits rather than just looking at surveilling black bodies and health behaviours. So there are, of course, Indigenous leadership over specific Indigenous investments in health.
Yes.
But Every day there are decisions made about our health system, about health research, mm-hmm. about health services that have a lived impact upon Indigenous peoples. And so I think part of it also is constantly having at the forefront of our minds, how does this affect Indigenous peoples? And if we're not asking the question, then that's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes you'll get health researchers who come through ethics processes, and because they don't want to do the full ethics process, will say that they're not including Indigenous peoples in their study. Now, I don't know how people in this day and age can be doing health research and not tick a box that there'd be a likely involvement of Indigenous peoples. And so I think that we have to, there is a part where we have to make this everybody's business, recognising that Indigenous peoples should be providing that strategic leadership and oversight and driving the agenda, but we should all be working towards Indigenous health improvements.
Why isn't this a requirement of getting a grant?
And engagement but it's reconfiguring the relationships within those. So, you know, there's often Indigenous health research grants where there are Indigenous people included, but they're always as the research assistant, not as the knower. So it's about going, okay, if we have Indigenous engagement, how meaningful is that engagement? And is there a redistribution of the power relationships that we're typically comfortable with? And I've been in situations where I've, you know, established structures or processes where Indigenous people have actual power in these arrangements, and people freak out over it. They really, and I've worked in a community and lived in a community context where I've always had to be accountable to Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. So I'm not scared by it. I actually trust my community to make the decisions that are in the best interests of our community.
And that's what white fellas need to do too.
Yeah, just so, well, maybe things, it won't be the end of the world. It just means that you don't get to exercise control over the natives. We're a country that's still yet to reconcile, and recognise, pardon the pun, but the unceded sovereignty of Indigenous peoples on this continent.
Oh, yeah.
And so it plays out in these spaces. There's this fear about the native population, and we're experiencing it, you know, every day, the fear of relinquishing control. I mean, that's one of the I think, the challenges in Indigenous health is just creating the space for us to be able to do the work that we need to do, that our communities have called us to do. Because, you know, my kids, they don't know a grandfather, you know. So, yes, this is deeply political, but it's also deeply personal because we're losing our people before their time. The significance of improving Indigenous health is far more profound and important for Indigenous peoples than what is appreciated.
All right, Chelsea, thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks for your time.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.